And Esau ran to meet him, Jacob, and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And he, Esau, lifted up his eyes and saw the women and the children and said, "Who are those with thee?" And he said, "The children which God hath graciously given thy servant." And the handmaidens came near, they and their children, and they bowed themselves. And Leah also with her children came near, and bowed themselves. And after came Joseph near, and Rachel, and they bowed themselves. And he said, "What meanest thou by all this drove which I met?" And he said, "These are to find grace in the sight of my Lord." And Esau said, "I have enough, my brother. Keep that thou hast unto thyself." And Jacob said, "Nay, I pray thee, if now I have found grace in thy sight, then receive my present at my hand. For therefore I have seen thy face, as though I had seen the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me. Take, I pray thee, my blessing that is brought to thee, because God hath dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough." And he urged him, and he took it. Last week we left Jacob and Esau in each other's arms, crying for joy at their being reunited. Far from being hostile, Esau's heart has been melted and changed toward Jacob, and Jacob, far from being killed by Esau, as he feared, beholds what God hath wrought. Now, when the brothers compose themselves sufficiently and stand up to talk, Esau's eyes fall upon the mothers and the children who are standing in little ranks behind Jacob, and he naturally asks, in the words of verse 5, "Who are those with thee?" When Jacob left home 20 years before, he was unmarried, and a lot has happened since then. And Jacob explains, verse 5, "The children which God hath graciously given thy servant." And then comes the introduction, as one by one those ranks of women and children bow respectfully to Esau. And this reminds Esau of another sight that met him earlier, the flocks and herds of animals. Verse 8, "What meanest thou by all this drove which I met?" And Jacob again explains, again verse 8, "These are to find grace in the sight of my Lord." And we see from these verses that Esau at first wants to refuse the gift, but Jacob keeps on insisting. And this is not a bit of sort of false to-ing and fro-ing here, but in this culture it matters very much that your gift is accepted by somebody who says that they've forgiven you and are reconciled to you. Because if the person accepts your gift, then they are in fact clinching the fact that they are reconciled to you. And so, to Jacob's relief, verse 11, he took it. And that was Esau saying very tangibly that all is now well between him and Jacob. I want us to notice one word that occurs twice in the conversation between Esau and Jacob as they haggle in this friendly way, and it's the word enough. Now, both men claim that they have enough. Verse 9, Esau said, "I have enough, my brother. Keep that thou hast unto thyself." Verse 11, Jacob says, "God hath dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough." And he urged Esau, and he took it. Esau then does not need the present. "I have enough, my brother." Jacob is anxious that he does accept it, and he says he can easily afford to give it Take, I pray thee, my blessing, because God hath dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough. Now, it's an interesting fact that although the two words, or the one word rather, enough, occurs twice, spoken by both Esau and Jacob, the word translated enough in the Hebrew is a different word. They're not both the same. If you look at verse 11, you'll see that Jacob's enough in the margin can read, I have all things. Whereas, although it doesn't say so in the margin, in verse 9, Esau's enough translated means simply much. So Esau's enough means I have much. Jacob's enough means I have all things. And of course there is a big difference, isn't there, between the two. And it reminds us that two men can use the same language, but they can mean different things in what they say. And let us consider then these two professions of having enough by these two men. Esau's enough and Jacob's enough. And I suggest to you that they will bring out the differences between these two men. First of all, Esau's enough, verse 9. I have enough, my brother. Now we have to say, don't we, that it is a refreshing change to find a worldly, profane man saying he has enough. Because you don't often find that. It's quite rare to find contentment, isn't it, among those who do not know God and who live for this world. Usually they are never satisfied. But at least it shows here in this one instance that there can be some who say they have enough and they are contented. Here is Esau with his 400 men, his followers. And we know that in chapter 27, verse 39 and verse 40, he had a share of his father's blessing, not the covenant part, the spiritual part that came to Jacob, but the earthly part. Chapter 27, verse 39, Isaac his father said unto him, Behold, thy dwelling shall be the fatness of the earth, and of the dew of heaven from above, and by thy sword shalt thou live, and so on. So there was an outward blessing that came upon Esau that was anchored to the earth and to this present world. But it was enough. It did satisfy him. And he did not need to be enriched by these flocks and herds that Jacob wanted to give him. There was a real absence, it would seem, of covetousness in Esau. And you know how the commandment about covetousness goes in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 17, the 10th commandment, mentioning the very things that Esau might have envied in Jacob. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. Well, it seems that Esau was not guilty of the sin of covetousness. And I say it's refreshing to read of it. And there is a general sense in which worldly people can, by and large, in some cases, be fairly content with what they have. However, we have to say that it was not completely so even then, because you see verse 9, I have enough, literally, I have much. Well, this leaves room for more, doesn't it? If it's a much. And it is implied that he might well have had more, and he would not have minded having more, although he didn't want to take it from Jacob. And you know, we are getting a bit deeper here, but while on the surface those who do not know the Lord can seem quite contented, they are not completely so. They say enough, but really they mean much, and there is room for more. much more. Because you see, a man who does not know God is someone who has a black hole in his soul, and it is never filled, and it is never ever satisfied. Only God can satisfy the void that is in a man. And if God is not his satisfaction, the world and the things of the world will be, but it will never be successful. You know, we would be surprised, I think, over the number of well-off people who do the lottery. Well-off people who nonetheless do the lottery. They have much, but they'd like very much more. And they'd like to change from being well-off to being millionaires. There is that something that still causes an underlying discontentment if God is not all and in all. The story is told of a woman who worked for a boss, and she was known to be very discontented. And one day she said in the hearing of the boss, "If only I had £50, I'd be contented. If I just had £50 more, I'd be contented." And the boss heard this, and he thought, right, I'll call her bluff and put her to the test. And so, in front of the other people, he gave her a £50 cheque. And the woman was absolutely amazed, and she took it with great gratitude. But as she turned and walked away, she said, "If only I'd have said £100. Never contented, you see. There's always that void that's left, but once more. And Esau is much. That's as far as he can go. And there is something more tragic than this, and that is that Esau could be as content as he is without God. For here is a man who's lost his birthright, when he sold it happily to Jacob. He's lost the covenant blessing when Jacob had it from him, because it was his by right. And so he has no part or lot in God. And the earth provides all that he wants in life. And he has much, he has enough. And he can be like that without God. And that's the tragedy, you see. He doesn't realize what he really needs, and who alone would enable him to say, "I have all." And that psalm that we sang earlier, Psalm 17, in the scriptures, Psalm 17 verse 14, that's a telling verse, isn't it, where we read this. What a telling verse. Psalm 17 verse 14, where David the psalmist prays that he might be delivered from men of the world, which have their portion in this life. And what a tragic description it is, isn't it, of such men. They have their portion in this life, no portion in God, but that's all they want, and they don't miss not having it in God. And notice how the verse goes on: "Whose belly thou, God, fillest with thy hid treasure." They are full of children and leave their substance to their babes, and so on. What it means is, what it means, God satisfies them. That is, God fills them with the things of this life. God gives them their portion in this world. And shall I tell you why God is so good to the ungodly? Because that's all they have. That's all they will have. And so he gives it to them all in this life, for they've got nothing in eternity. And remember that, dear friends, when you are tempted to envy the prosperity of the wicked. You see, they've got it all now. That's all they'll ever have. And God is very kind to them, because he's not going to give them his heaven, and he's not going to give them eternal life, and he's not going to give them glory. But being a good God, he gives them their portion in this life. But what a tragedy. Esau has enough. but he's not got what Jacob has got. And do you notice in that Psalm 17 verse 14, from men which are thy hand, O Lord, from men of the world, which have their portion in this life. And the ungodly in their prosperity are described there as God's hand. Why is that? Well, because God by that means disciplines us. He uses the ungodly in their prosperity and their being satisfied as a discipline for us. And it is a test sometimes, isn't it? As we see our neighbour perhaps along the way, who doesn't have any of the problems that we have because we are Christians. None of the struggles and the conflicts and the dilemmas and the doubts and the fears, the afflictions, the disciplines, the heartaches. Of course, none of the joys and the blessings, but none of the chastisements. But it all goes well. Really amazing, isn't it? The whole weekend to themselves, every evening of the week, all their money their own to do with whatever they please. Endless pleasure, and all goes well. And then we are tempted to be like Asaph in Psalm 73. We make the comparisons, you see, and we look at our poor lives and we think, well, I don't know. Look at me, look at my family, look at us, look at other believers. And really it's, and the devil comes and says, you know, you'd be better off if you weren't on the Lord's side. You'd be better off if you were on the world's side. They fare much better. And you see, this is the Lord's hand to test us and to discipline us and to make us really certain, so that we really are assured that we believe what we ought to believe here. Because you see, Asaph was brought to a position of assurance when he went into the sanctuary of God, you remember, and considered their end. And he thought, yes, they have it all in this life. Their end, though, their end. They're going to leave it all behind. And then they've got to face God. And they've got no heaven. And you see, that sometimes is a discipline for us. And Esau, the Esaus of this world, merrily going on their way, are a discipline for Jacob. But the tragedy is, they have enough, they have much, and they don't want anything in God. Well, that's Esau's enough. And you see, how things look now is one thing. It's how it will look the split second after death that will count. And it is only for this time, this present time. Let's remember that, dear friends. Because if you don't have that eternal perspective on matters, if you judge things from the standpoint of this present world, you will be tempted to stumble. And you'll be tempted to envy and fret. And you'll be tempted to be discontented with your lot and how God is dealing with you. But you see, God is saying the best is yet to be. Suffer a little now and be glorified hereafter. Whereas the ungodly, they're glorified now, but they suffer hereafter. It's the end. It's only in this life that they have their portion. Enough without God. Well, that is Esau's enough. Much, much to be pitied, though very generous to his brother Jacob on this occasion. But let's look at something better. Jacob's enough. Now in verse 11, this is the language of a man who understood how things really are. Verse 11. Take, I pray thee, my blessing that is brought to thee, because God hath dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough, literally, all things. Now he is satisfied and contented, but in a complete way. Now what has made this difference? What does he mean then? How can he say this? Well, it starts, doesn't it, with what he said in verse 5. Esau said, who are those with thee, the mothers and the children? And he said, the children which God hath graciously given thy servant. Now that's something Esau would never say, not even recognize. But Jacob can say it, these children, God has graciously given them to me. He's only recognizing the truth of what we read in previous chapters, where we read, God opened the womb of Leah, God gave conception, and so on. It's the blessing of God when children come. It's the gift of God, isn't it, to mothers and fathers. And you see, Jacob is echoing that, and he is able to say what God has given him. And that contributes to his feeling that he has all things. He's satisfied. Because when you see what you have as having come directly from God, that invests what you have with a capacity to make you contented. You see, with the unbeliever, the things he's got, he doesn't really know where they've come from. He attributes it mostly to himself, I suppose. And it's not the same as for one who knows the Lord. Let me illustrate it this way. A husband might not be able to give his wife a hugely expensive gift, but with his hard-earned money, he plans and he thinks and he chooses, and he gives a nice present with all the love of his heart, and the wife receives it and is deeply touched and treasures that gift. Now, if she possessed 5 times the amount of money and could buy the equivalent 5 times as big, it wouldn't mean the same as this smaller thing that has come from him. And does she not say, in effect, this is everything to me? Because of the source. The fact that it's come from one who loves her, invests it with such a capacity to satisfy her and make her so happy in it and contented with it. And she treasures it. And dear friends, for us as believers, everything we have has come from one whom we read about in 1 Timothy 6 and verse 17. That God gives to us richly all things to enjoy. Now, when you see your gifts, possessions, and whatever you have as coming directly from God, that transforms your view of what you have. And you see that everything is a love gift. Everything in providence is a blessing. God is behind it. And so it transforms how we look at things. I have all, everything, all I want, all I need. I'm happy and satisfied with that. A satisfaction far superior than what an unbeliever finds in the things he's got. That's, of course, why so often the ungodly who got masses of wealth are not satisfied and not happy in it. The power to have access to buying whatever you like, with thousands and millions even, it becomes in the end something that palls and something that loses its shine. It's insignificant then. Better, what does the book of Proverbs say? Better that a righteous man has, a little that a righteous man has. Better is little that a righteous man has than the riches of many wicked. Because it's not the quantity, it's the quality. I have much. I have enough, rather. I have enough. I have all things. And just before we leave verse 5, will you notice that Jacob is in the presence of an ungodly man. And yet Jacob says, the children which God hath graciously given thy servant. In other words, there's no thought in Jacob's mind, I mustn't mention God, because Esau isn't a believer. He's not afraid and not ashamed to say, God has given it to me. And I think this brings us up short, doesn't it? Because I think we, as Christians, and I'm sure I speak for us all, myself included, we sometimes are very careful how we speak in the presence of the ungodly. And we sort of veil our Christian words and terms. And then we sound like them, don't we? But there was nothing of that here. The children which God gave me. And I wonder how casually we would be able to mention God's gifts when speaking to unbelievers in conversation. And I wonder if we're not guilty of hiding our light under a bushel when Jacob here puts us to shame, doesn't he? It could be quite a witness. I know, of course, we can overdo it. And I know it wouldn't be helpful to forever be introducing God's name and spiritual things into general conversation with unbelievers. But now and again, unashamedly, to say, God has blessed me with this, or this is God's gift to me, or something like that. Tremendous, you know. They would never credit it. They'd never heard that sort of thing before. It might well be the beginning of serious thinking about these things. What a witness it would be. We who are so blessed, wouldn't it be good to tell others unashamedly, well, the Lord has blessed me in this. Thank God for it. And then another thing that helps Jacob with his enough is, look at verse 10. For therefore, he says to Esau, I have seen thy face, as though I had seen the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me. He's referring, of course, to the fact that Esau is now smiling at him, beaming at him, and Jacob is so thankful that he's found Esau's face to be like this. But notice what Jacob is actually saying here to Esau. I have seen thy face, thy now smiling face, as though I had seen the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me. He means that Esau's face is towards him now like the face of God, like he's used to viewing the face of God. Pleased with me. Remember chapter 32 and verse 30? Jacob named that place Peniel, for I have seen God's face, or seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. What face was it that Jacob saw, as much as he could bear, be permitted to bear in that encounter? It must have been a face that was pleased, a smiling face. Because now he says, I've seen your face, Esau, smiling at me, as though I'd seen the face of God, pleased with me. And that's quite remarkable, isn't it? So, the way that Jacob just incidentally refers to the face of God is a smiling one, like Esau's is to him now. Now, how do you think of God's face? How do you view God as being disposed towards you? And I suggest that far too often we tend to, in our mind's eye, view God's countenance as dark looks, a displeased look. And sometimes we Christians are guilty because of unbelief, really, and failure to see what we are in Christ. We are guilty of viewing God as almost looking displeased with us much of the time. And we live under the cloud, a shadow. Well, Jacob wasn't like that, was he? I've seen your smiling face, Esau, just like I'm used to seeing the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me. Now, I find that tremendous. That it's obvious that Jacob was used to contemplating and conceiving of God's face as smiling. Doesn't that put us to shame? And yet, dear friends, that's how we are entitled to view God as disposed to us. You see, does he not love us in Christ? And like Jacob, is he not our God in the covenant? The God of Jacob then is our God now, the same. And this Bible speaks everywhere in the Old Testament, doesn't it? The light of thy countenance, not the darkness of thy countenance, the light of thy countenance. The smile, the joy, the pleasure felt in God toward his people. Do we view it like that, I wonder? In Psalm 4 and verse 6, David is surrounded by people. Sometimes we find that, don't we? Complainers and moaners and groaners. Oh, who will show us any good? People so discontented and so dissatisfied, always chuntering and always finding something to criticize and find fault with. Some people can be like that, can't they? Psalm 4 and verse 6. There be many that say, who will show us any good? Now, what's David's? good that he says can be shown. Lord, lift thou up the light of thy countenance upon us. Verse 7, thou hast put gladness in my heart more than in the time of harvest. See, that's the good. It's always there, isn't it? The light of God's countenance. To feel it, to know that the Lord takes pleasure in his people, in those who hope in his mercy. You know, the ultimate blessing of heaven, Revelation 22 and verse 4, they shall see his face, the smiling face of God. But it's there now. If you wear the righteousness of Christ and you are accepted in God's beloved Son, God looks upon you as he looks upon his Son and is pleased with you. I have seen thy face like I see the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me like God is pleased with me. That's a tremendous thing, isn't it? Now, you feel like that and you can say that, you say, I've got everything. I've got all. Thy loving kindness is better than life. What a wonderful thing to enjoy, isn't it? Would that more often than we do, we could break out of the shadows, dear friends, and break out of the gloom and the overcastness of our spiritual experience, and come away from lack of assurance and doubts and misgivings about our standing and acceptance before God, and realize that God has said it, that justification by grace in Christ means that God sees no sin in us, and God sees the righteousness of his own Son upon us, and therefore he accepts us and is pleased with us. And that is the only reason why we can pray and worship and serve him and have joy and assurance and peace and believing. Well, Jacob knew it, didn't he? For all his ups and downs and all his difficulties in life. And that meant more to him than all that Esau had. And that is, I have enough all things. And then the last thing that enabled Jacob to be able to testify to his having everything was this. Look in verse 11. Oh, take, I pray thee, my blessing that is brought to thee, because God hath dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough. And what a thing to be able to say, isn't it? Of his checkered life, these 20 years, God has dealt graciously with me. Undeserved love, unmerited favour. The word means kindness and pity, compassion and mercy. Yes, when he was forced to run away from home as a fugitive, when he was exploited by Laban, his wages changed and him defrauded of his wages, and terrible working conditions, frost by night, heat by day, family heartaches with the squabbles between his wives and the rivalry between the children, the fear of meeting Esau again. What a checkered life, what a difficult, tried life, and yet God has dealt graciously with me. Through it all, I've been upheld and comforted and helped through. I've got everything. I couldn't have any more than this. Nothing could be put to this. This produces a contentment and satisfaction. Psalm 116 verse 7. Return unto thy rest, O my soul, for the Lord hath dealt bountifully with me. There's a sense that all is well here. Everything's perfect, in spite of the fact that I've passed through all this and might well be passing through a lot more as well. But as for God, his way is perfect. You see, it's discontent and dissatisfaction that arises from a knowledge that things might have been different or could have been better. If only. But there's none of that with Jacob. I have all. God has dealt graciously with me. He's not justifying his sin, not extenuating the wrong things he's done. But overall, there's been the sovereignty of God and the dealings of God with Jacob, and God's worked it all together for good, and you can't put anything to perfection, can you? Can't improve perfection. I've got everything. God has been gracious to me. Could not have been better. Would not have been otherwise. The Lord has had his way. It was all meant to be and had to be. That saves a man from a lifetime of regret, doesn't it? And ruining certain things. I have all. Jacob's enough. Now we must close by going over to Philippians chapter 4, because you see, if you want the New Testament equivalent of all this, then you have it most wonderfully in the Apostle Paul, don't you? Philippians chapter 4. And it's exactly the same for the apostle as it was for Jacob. Philippians 4 verse 11. He's mentioning the great generosity of these Philippians in the gifts they sent him while in prison at Rome. Not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. He says, I know how to be abased and how to abound and so on. But look at verse 18. But I have all. Same language, you see. I have all and abound. I am full. Having received of Epaphroditus the things which were sent from you, something well pleasing to God, my God shall supply all your need and so on. But I've got everything. It's not that I would have been otherwise if you hadn't sent any of these gifts to me. I'm content. Isn't that amazing? Here's a man under house arrest in prison at Rome, chained at the wrists, under armed guard, four guards at a time, not certain whether he's going to live or be executed at his hearing, as a result of his hearing before Caesar. I have all, like Jacob. What a wonderful thing to be able to say, God is God to Paul. God is God to his people. In 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 10, Paul could write about himself like this: as having nothing and yet possessing all things. It's an amazing paradox that is, isn't it? Having virtually nothing and yet possessing all things. He's learned the secret. With God, everything. That's Jacob's enough. That's Paul's enough. And you see, the more you know God, and the more you discover the riches of his grace to you, and the more he reveals himself to you and becomes your covenant God in Christ, the more you'll feel that you have everything. Infinitely more than the richest people in the world. They are paupers. We are rich. And at the end of the day, you see, two men on their deathbeds, one a Christian, the other not. Who's the richest? Who's the richest? You can have a millionaire on his deathbed. You can have a humble believer with little of this goods, this world's goods, on his deathbed. It's obvious who's the richest. That's how you measure how much you have. May the Lord then be everything to us, and may we be able to speak Jacob's enough, because we know the God of Jacob as he did. Let us sing together hymn